I do want to let you guys know you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, worldwide at kpfk.org. You're currently listening to Melting Pot, which is generally here every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. And today we have a guest in our studios. His name is Robin Hannibal. He is the producer, the conductor of a lot of different things, but most prominently here in 2013, he's had a couple different records with two different bands, Rye and the album Woman, and Quadrin in their album Avalanche. And I think that if we kind of start to shift a little bit to talking more about the Quadrin record, a lot of what you said about how the Rye project came together explains a lot of the kind of sonic differences between the groups. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like from really both of these records now that we have two records from Quadrin, that both of these records, kind of the production style is a bit more referential to kind of influences that you've had and other artists who've clearly have been some of your favorites. And I felt like that was a little less clear with the Rye record and that kind of process of wanting to pull back and do something really different seems to really have explained that.
I think so too, and I agree with you. And I think also, you know, with collaboration with Mike is also a lot newer, and we actually only did those 10 songs that is on the album, you know, and for this album with Quadrin, we wrote I think 45 or 50 songs.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and then we chose 10. So the development was also different, and it's also different when you are working on your second album, no matter what it is that you do. You start becoming more selective, and also you start noticing certain patterns that you go into, and you do that because of your prior work with that project. You know, so you start like, this maybe sounds a little bit too much like that song that we had on that. You know, and then you get into that, and the first album you don't, so it feels like a bit more of an open field. You know,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean the Quadrin album and the Quadrin project is definitely springs from or comes from our love for, you know, urban music, and there is more references just because though that is the music that me and Coco kind of share, like that we have between us that we kind of can understand and relate to, and the music that me and Mike relate to, I think, is a little bit different. It's different songs, and it's different textures, and it's different elements, you know. And because he's also a producer, the language is a little bit different, you know. Whereas with Quadrin, it's our love for Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and some of these greats, Sade, and those are the things that we kind of use to explain things to each other. So it is definitely a little bit more inspired by urban music, and also has more references for sure.
And it seems like this record, in comparison to the first record, which I think had I'm taking something back before I even say it. But I was going to say that it seemed like the first record had maybe more references, but actually this record has quite a few different reference points as well. But it seems like Avalanche has, like, there's a little bit more Michael in Avalanche than the first record. And I'm wondering if part of that it relates to just where it was recorded and kind of the actual kind of recording process and being in Los Angeles.
Totally. It is. I mean, it's, you know, like, we don't want to get a little too fanatical, but I will say that there are certain things that are you know, they're kind of interesting. I mean, we did sign with Epic Records, that is under Sony, and Epic was the label that released all of Michael Jackson's solo albums.
Stuff.
And also we worked a lot out of a studio called Westlake, which was, you know, Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones' old stomping grounds, and where he did the bulk of his albums and music in the 80s and late 70s. So, you know, making the music on the same equipment, the same rooms, all this memorabilia everywhere, and also, using certain musicians that had either played with him or had been in connection with him,
mm-hmm.
Being signed by L.A. Reid and Tricky Stewart, who had both worked with him as well. Definitely, you know, had an impact. And we also felt, you know, that we both had the belief that, you know, you need to step things up every time you do something, or you need to up the ante. You know, you need to try more.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes trying more is less. But in this case, trying more was more, because the first album I had envisioned as to kind of showcase Coco's voice, so I never wanted it to be too full. I never wanted it to have too many vocal details as well, to, you know, wanted it to just kind of have space for, you know, Coco's voice. Basically this time around we thought it'd be interesting to kind of add more, you know, more harmonies, more vocal details, and more arrangement as well, and also because we had a budget for it, so we added, you know, a lot more players and more, you know, orchestral elements as well. So
yeah, let's hear a little, actually, in some ways, the, you know, the song brings together a lot of what you were just talking about. All the different elements that you were talking about is the track Neverland.
Yeah.
And so let's listen to this track. This is from Quadrant, from their record came out in the summer, a real kind of summer record, a perfect record for the summer. And the, one of the tracks from it, Neverland, right now, that you're going to hear on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Thank you.
Music from Quadrin here on KPFK and Melting Pot. From the album Avalanche, released in June of this year, the song was Neverland. Robin Hannibal of Quadrin is here in our studios. We've been talking to him for about an hour here at KPFK and Melting Pot about these various projects. One of the things we were just talking about this, and it was something, you know, a difference between the first record and this record, but just entirely like in what you hear. Because as soon as I realized it, I listened to the other one and it was like, it was there all over the place. And I couldn't believe, I was like, why didn't I hear this? Hmm. But like hearing Coco's voice over productions that don't sound exactly like what was on Off the Wall or Thriller, but kind of feel like they're in that spirit, like they have the feel of it. All of a sudden I realized how much her voice really sounds like Michael, like kind of little Michael Jackson, not at the time like that, but like when he was in the Jackson 5, there are a lot of things she does with her voice that sounds so much like Michael.
Totally. And I mean, he's the main inspiration, and you know, it's not even, you know, I'm not even making this up when I say that there would be a lot of times when we're at studios and you know, we wouldn't know where to go, or we were unsure if this was the right direction, and we would, you know, just look at each other and say in unison, like, what would Michael do? Like, we'd just literally be like, what would Michael do in this situation? And I think, you know, in a lot of people love Michael Jackson, so it's, you know, we're not trying to say that we know or understand him better or we love him more than anybody else does, but I think the way that we use him is just that he's an inspiration for how he wants to perfect everything. Mm. You know, this amazing drive and this amazing strive for perfection and doing something that, like, outdoing yourself all the time. I think that's how we use him the most, and thinking, you know, what would be the not obvious thing to do, mm-hmm. that would a lot of the times be what he would do, you know. And he threw a lot of curveballs, like during his career. He definitely did. He definitely didn't make the same album and the same song again and again and again. Like, yeah. he had comfort zones and sweet spots like anybody else, but I think what's remarkable about him was that he was always looking for something new. He was always interested. He was always trying new things out, production techniques, different styles of songs. And a lot of his music is very conceptual as well, which is very inspiring when you're working on music too. And it was something that me and Coco kind of met through. It was through the love of Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. So it's a language that we can kind of talk, you know, and sometimes we would put on a song and in the studio is like, oh, wow. Like when he does that, like, that's, you know, so dope. Like, let's see if we can, you know, make that into our own, or, you know, get inspired by it. So you're totally right about it. And this one, and there's a couple of other songs as well where we were definitely trying to, you know, get the inspiration, the divine inspiration. Yeah,
it's one of the things that I appreciate about the work that you do in all these different areas. And I mean, at the top of the show, we played a set of, you know, I guess like five different projects: Quadrin, Boomclap Bachelors, Rye. Those are still pretty much ongoing.
Yeah.
There was the collaboration with Philip Owusu, and Owusu and Hannibal, and also kind of your own project as Bobby. And the thing that I think is the kind of connective tissue between them all is this incredible attention to detail and attention to sound. It really, like, there's not a lot of wasted space or wasted sounds. Like, it seems really important to you as a producer, as a songwriter, and somebody who puts this music together to really have everything matter that's kind of in the mix.
I mean, yeah, I don't know what to say. That's exactly what I what I want. So yeah, that's the perfect explanation. Yeah, what else is there to say to that? Yeah, that is totally what I go for, and I guess I just think that there's a big difference between live music and recorded music.
Mm.
Not that recorded music has to be perfect, because I love flaws and I love things that are off kilter as well, and I love using those as well, and mistakes as well. I use that a lot. But I do like the fact that everything is very well thought through, because once it's recorded, it's documented, and that's how it will be. And I think that if you spend so much time on making something, you want it to be relevant, or at least try to be relevant for numerous years. You want to try and make something that isn't just a product of its time, but something that hopefully, you know, can stand the test of time, and that has something universal and timeless in it. So that is something that I'm very meticulous and very aware of and very focused on when I make music. And it goes into the sounds, it goes into the songwriting as well, and it goes into the overall production and arrangement as well. And it is definitely from listening to a lot of music from, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, where I do think that, you know, the business was bigger, so you had more people involved, you had more geniuses working on the same song, and you spent a lot of time on some of these albums, you know, like the some of these amazing albums that we still listen to took three or four years.
Very true.
You know? And that is very different in this day and age, where, you know, we're consumers and we need to, you know, push out product all the time, and, you know, time is money and this whole thing. And therefore, to me, it, you know, because I really enjoy these albums and I still listen to them, I want to try and get some of that into what I do, you know, today. So most albums that I do work on do take 1 to 2 years to make. Mm-hmm. I haven't made an album in shorter time. The Rye record took 1.5 years. The Quadrant album took 2 years. And there's a lot of editing and choices that has to be made in that process. You know, there's, like I said, with the Quadrant album, there was 50 songs, and 20 of those were fully orchestrated.
Oh, wow.
Like, fully. But we only chose 10.
Did you actually record all those songs?
Yeah. We tracked all of it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. And we had, you know, we had 3 songs with Pharrell. We had 2 songs with Rafael Sadiq. We had a song with Kendrick that didn't make it. Kendrick Lamar as well. And we had a lot of songs that definitely were good. It just didn't fit, you know. And I think that is also something that we're gradually just becoming worse at, is editing and actually just choosing what really works. And that's also the thought behind both Rye's album and Quadrant's album only being 10 songs.
Yeah.
Wanting it to be an album, you know, that is cohesive and that works and is thought of, instead of just a selection of, you know, 15, 20 songs, which is what most urban or urban influenced albums are nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they don't know what they want, and they just end up choosing a little bit of everything, you know.
Well, I mean, it may be part of what they want is they want to have more product out there that people can potentially buy.
True.
And focusing on that quantity as opposed to quality is, you know, part of the problem with a lot of mainstream music.
I think so.
And a couple, there's, because started off as a purely independent musician all the way in Denmark, and then coming to the States and getting greater exposure, but still largely through independent labels. And then in the last couple of years, kind of getting major backing, there are kind of a couple of aspects of how that's, what I'm curious about, that in terms of how it's kind of changed you as an artist and a musician and all that. And some of it, I think one part of it is on the production aspect, because it's clear between the first Quadrant record and this Quadrant record that they are different, completely different beasts in terms of production. And I imagine some of that has to do with the differences in budget and all that. But I'm also really interested, and I'll probably come back to it, because there may be kind of like follow-up questions connected to the production aspect. But I'm really interested also just in kind of how it affects your sensibilities as an artist once you kind of make that jump. You know, I would imagine it's kind of like somebody who grew up working class their whole lives, and then they make something and make a lot of money from it.
Yeah.
And now they can't really say they're in the working class anymore. No. They're in the upper class. Like, that's in some ways your position as a musician now. But first, I really wanted to kind of focus on process and production. So just in thinking about that, kind of the differences between making that first Quadrant record and making this record now with additional backing and like a real proper budget.
Yeah.
So what could you say about that?
Well, I mean, you're right. Like, they do sound different. And I think also we could have made the same album, because I still, you know, enjoy that production. But to me, it's important that whenever I start on something, I wanna develop. I wanna do something that I haven't done before, because I feel if I've already done it, the only thing I can get out of it would be to be compared to what I already did.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to move, you know, and constantly move and develop and grow. So we always talked about that, you know, if we ever did take the check, so to speak, and went that route, that it would be great to, you know, make the album that we'd always envisioned, you know, lush and with, you know, a tremendous amount of detail, that would have the reminiscences of that era of 70s and 80s where you know you just put the string section on there, you know, regardless of if it was a dance song or of a ballad, you know, and you know, the 32-piece band, you just, you know, you had to put it on, you know, just because, you know, you wanted that. Like, why wouldn't you want that? Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's a little bit different. You know, it's looked as an unnecessary cost.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the musicality of that is just, it's amazing. It's colors, you know, that we're just stripped of now. And I've missed that, and just missed the opportunity to do that, because I was born way later. So having that opportunity was definitely something that we wanted to pursue in making that album. It's true, there are different there's a different pressure on you, and there's different expectations. But I will have to say, though, that, and maybe this is just me having been extremely fortunate and lucky, but both albums, the Rye album and the Quadrant album, was made without any involvement. So it's, you know, 100% our realization, or, you know, our creation that we came with. And part of that is probably that as Quadrant, we already had a concept, a project, a sound when we signed, whereas a lot of acts and a lot of artists or singers and whatnot, they get signed before they've actually really done something. They've done a couple of demos, but we already had something, you know, it was in the making, but they knew what they got.
Yeah.
And so they had much more belief in us, and they just gave us a year to work in studios and use musicians, and they were, you know, we got to do the album that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then all the other blah 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 came in, you know, later down the line, and that always comes in. But end of the day, the album that you're sitting with is the album that we wanted to make. And with Rye, the album was already done before we signed with a major.
Mm.
So, you know, and that was the whole, you know, that was the whole argumentation and selling point was that, you know, we'll do it, but only if this is the album and nothing gets changed.
Mm.
You know, like this is what needs to be released. So I've been very fortunate in this regard, you know, whereas I know most of the times as a debut act, you don't have a lot to say.
Yeah.
You know, so I've only been interested in doing it because we've been able to do it on our terms.
Mm.
And with the music not changing. And the reason I think why I was able to do that also was because I've worked in the music business and lived off of music for 10 years actually now.
Mm-hmm.
And before these things, 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing okay without it, you know, so I wasn't just taking it to get the check or to, you know, pay for my rent. I knew the hustle and I knew how to grind, you know, so it was because I saw that it was possible to do something bigger, you know, and get the music even more out there and just have more people work it instead of me and two people on some indie label. There's all of a sudden there's a huge company that needs to work it, you know, because they betted on it, they gambled on it,
mm-hmm.
and that makes for a different culture and also for a different process altogether. So yeah, I mean, end of the day, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily one thing that's better than the other, and it's something that every artist kind of has to make up their mind about what it is that they want to do and how they want to do it, and both have advantages and disadvantages for sure, but I'm happy I did it solely because I was able to still keep the music the way I wanted it to.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, kind of the approach that you've had and in some respects still have to making music kind of allows you to weather whatever storms may or may not come. You know, that it's I would not, and you know, it's good I can tell you this in person. You know, like I would not expect you to all of a sudden have a real drop off in quality, kind of chasing a hit,
chasing
that money, kind of thing, because in a lot of respects, you know, you've done it both ways, and you're totally comfortable,
yeah,
kind of in that space. One of the things though with this kind of added budget and the ability to use more musicians, because so much of the early recordings was pretty much just you, right?
Yeah.
And I would imagine, just given the time frame for when the Rye record was recorded, that again it was mainly just you and Mike.
Yeah.
But now you like it's, you know, like it is. It's like the 32-piece orchestra and all
totally,
that.
Yeah.
You know, so do you still feel like the kind of the way we kind of talked about this music and kind of trying to put it into a genre was as electronic soul, but especially with this latest Quadrant record, and I would imagine kind of what comes next from Rye, it seems like it'll be less and less electronic and more, I don't know exactly the word I want to use, but you know what I'm saying?
I think I know what you mean. I think it's always really important for me that there's some organic elements, and if that is, you know, the strings that makes it organic, or if it's the drums that make it organic, or whatever it is, I love the imperfections of real instrumentation, even if they're amazing players. It's just the frequencies and the harmonies of real instruments just makes for a different quality than something that's been quantized and chopped up and edited to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know where things are going. I don't really view it that way, because I always add like electronic elements into the music, and it just really depends on the project. It depends on what you know, what people can afford as well. Like I do productions for other artists as well. I've started to do it even more the last 3 or 4 months, ever since kind of these big out like albums or the like my part of it is kind of over with, mm-hmm. in many ways now. So it just depends on what the artist is, what they want, and I enjoy the differences sonically as well, you know. And I don't know what the next thing will be, but I definitely have like a musical rash right now in my body.
Yeah, that you're itching to get some new things.
That is itching, and I think I'm probably becoming more and more ideological with age as well, in regards to focus on the good song and also like the good arrangement, you know, and less worried about like how much is this and how much is that, like how much is of it is this is electronic or how much of it is organic, or is this the, you know, the modern drum sounds, or is it not? Or, you know, like it matters less and less to me. I'm still super interested in it, and I research it, and I'm excited about it, but it matters less and less because I've recognized that it doesn't really mean that much. And I think it's probably also something that you're more focused on when you're younger, when you're in your like start 20s, and as a teenager you're more interested in sound, and everything, and a lot of this these days is sound design, you know, like a lot of music is more designed than it's an actual like song, yeah, you know, that actually does something to you, and that has probably given me even more of an incentive to make it more musical and make it more live, you know, because I feel that there is this crazy sound design thing going on right now that I'm just so over and so tired of. I thought it was really interesting when it happened, you know, 10 years ago, and I've done it a little bit, and the Wus und Hannibal record, which was the first album I kind of like really did, had a lot of that. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of like the beat elements, because I thought it was interesting to mix up. But then through the years, I feel like it's gotten to be more and more just beats, and less focus on the actual songs. And I only think the beats are interesting if it's mixed with songs and music. So that's probably the answer to your question, is that it's probably a little bit of a reaction, yeah, to that, you know, that I'm a little tired of a lot of form and not a lot of content, uh-huh, sometimes.
Well, you know, we're going to have to figure out something, you know, a new term for this at some point.
Yeah.
Just want to let you guys know, we are talking right now to Robin Hannibal, who is in both the band Quadrin and also Rye. Rye is going to be performing next Saturday as part of the Culture Collide Festival, performing at the church in Echo Park. We actually have tickets for the festival. And in addition to Rye, it's an incredible festival going on all weekend. Alice Russell is going to be performing, King Khan and the Shrines, a variety of different artists all over kind of the Echo Park area and other parts of Los Angeles. We'll have tickets for that a little bit later. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, because I think in some ways this actually, it connects to what we were just mentioning and how the kind of changing dynamics of your career and also the changing dynamics of your sound. There also is this, I guess we could call it a solo project, which is Bobby. And some of these elements seem like they're also kind of being worked out in the way you put together music for this project.
Yeah.
And could you say a little bit about kind of what, because I also thought, especially with the EP that came out a little while ago, that it seemed that Bobby might be kind of an avenue for a bit more kind of avant-garde-y yeah. kind of arrangements.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about this project?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it kind of came about that way because these were songs that I had lying and I tried to push to different artists.
Yeah.
And they would hear it and they'd be like, oh, it's interesting, but it's a little off.
Mm.
And then I just, in the end, thought, you know, I might as well just do it on my own. Because I always demo songs, you know. Sometimes I demo them completely with, you know, verse, chorus, blah, 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 blah. But most of the times I just demo them a tad because I want whatever singer, artist to kind of imagine what they could do to it, like what they can add to it. So, you know, I had done that and I just thought it might be interesting if I actually like really did it, like really sang them properly, which I never do. I just demo things like once, you know, whereas if I record somebody, we'll do 20 takes and I'll take the best take, you know, like it's a process getting to the great recording. And like you stack all these different harmonies and elements and you double the lead and the vocals and blah, blah, blah. I thought that'd be interesting if I actually just tried that out with my own voice. And so I did. And it was an experiment using songs that I wasn't using for anybody else. And I thought it had something. So I just ended up releasing it. And then I just haven't had time to do more, actually, and often wanted to. And then I had two songs lying around that I have to, though, admit aren't actually new. They are some years old. This last one I did the year I came to the States, 2010, late 2010, and the other one that has also just been released was made in March 2010. So they're actually 3 years old. And I've developed, I think, hopefully, knock on wood, a little bit vocally as well since, but I'm still waiting for the little period of time where I can kind of get in again and you know, do something that is me now and is a little bit more developed vocally as well. But I really enjoy these two songs that are a couple of years old, and I thought it'd be fun to kind of release them, and I'm doing a video for it as well. And you know, it's fun because it's a different side, and I enjoy it.
Why don't we listen to one of these tracks from Robin Hannibal's project Bobby? This is one of these new songs. It's actually an old song, but it's a new song to us at least, for the most part. This one is Tame the Shrew, released on Matthew Schreier's Kieris Chicle record label. You're hearing it right now on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Run and try.
Music from Robin Hannibal as Bobby here on KPFK and Melting Pot. Tame the Shrew, the name of the song, releases a digital, only digital, correct?
So far.
So far, only yes. Digital single by Matthew Schreier's record label, Kiaris Chicle. And Robin Hannibal is here in the studio with us. I think in some respects, one of the reasons that I wanted you to come in was just so I could settle, you know, where the kind of the reference was for the song. It was Janet Jackson, more or less, kind of unconsciously, it seems.
But
the Jacksons loom large.
Oh,
for sure.
I mean,
in the mind of Robin Hannibal.
For sure. I mean, the regards to voice, like Coco can reach for a young MJ, but I think I'll have to settle for Janet. I don't mind that at all. But yeah. It definitely has that, and you know, this kind of ostinato synthesizer jazz bass line, you know, where you kind of play the chord is a very Rod Temperton-ish type of thing, and he was one of the chief songwriters on Michael Jackson's albums.
Yeah.
And this white British dude from I believe it's like Oxford or something, and he was in Heat Wave to begin with, and then he was recruited by Quincy, and he did a lot of these songs that has these very like signature synth bass lines that never really move, and then things move around it, and that was a big inspiration as well. And then obviously early Janet is really
When you listen to a track like that, like it sounds it like it's, you know, it's an upbeat track, like it's a track that moves you, and it sounds like in singing like you're having a good time. But it's singing is like it's always been kind of Robin Hannibal and somebody through almost all these different projects.
Yeah.
Are you getting more comfortable with your voice?
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, I'll tell you a quick anecdote if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I had a moment where I really discovered as well that, you know, it's in many ways also about owning it. We had the big pleasure of working with Pharrell for this Quadrant album, and even though none of the songs we made with him made the album, it was a big experience because I never get to work with any other producers. I'm always the producer in the room.
Yeah,
you know, and it was so liberating to see somebody that were in many ways working the same way as me. At least me and Coco were sitting there kind of laughing because it felt, you know, it felt very much like now I had to experience what it is to be her.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what I thought was great was that, you know, and he's, I mean, I really enjoy his singing, but, you know, you wouldn't maybe say that he's a natural singer either, but I think he has a really, really good voice. And he has great sense of melody and understanding as well, but he just didn't care. Like he wasn't too interested in sounding perfect or he had no ego in regards to his voice.
Yeah,
like it was just an extension of him, and that was so liberating to see that somebody that known and that acclaimed had no problem just kind of like taking his heart out and like putting it on the table, you know, and have everybody to like dissect. And that made me change a little bit my perception as well about voice, because I think especially with voice, there's a whole, you know, is the person a good singer or a bad singer? Like there's a lot of like technicality or technique involved in it, or like is it good or is it bad?
Yeah,
but it really, what it really is, it's emotion, you know, and it's some kind of quality that makes you want to connect, and that's how I look at it now. So that definitely that made me change that. So yeah, I am much more comfortable with it now. At least also to the point where if I'm sitting with somebody, I'll just start singing away, not caring, you know, if it's the right notes or if it's not, you know, just let's just share.
That's good. That's good. You know, I mean, it's you're already making, you know, fantastic music, but I imagine this is, you know, really going to open up some new doors,
you know.
as you move forward. I mean, you're getting hopefully, I think right now, kind of much deserved time off after all these projects. But yeah, it fills us with you know, some hope and anticipation of what will come in the ensuing years from the variety of different projects. And it's really been a pleasure once again.
Likewise,
to talk
sir.
With you. You know, thank you so much for coming in.
It's been an utmost pleasure, and I haven't done this since we did it last time, I think. And I wanted to do it again because I enjoyed it so much last time.
We actually, originally when we talked about this, we were going to have you do like a guest DJ set, and you and I, we just got to talking and you know, that's the way it goes. But you know, hopefully sometime in the near future, I really would love to have you come in again. You know, and maybe give us a taste of what's new, but also play some tunes.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
Love to.
Yeah, thank you so much once again, Robin.
Pleasure.
I'm going to leave you with some music from Rye. They once again are performing as part of the Culture Collide Festival that's going on here in Los Angeles Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October 10th, 11th, and 12th at a variety of different venues. Rye is going to play on Saturday, October 12th at the church in Echo Park. The tickets that we have two pairs of these, and they actually are for the entire festival. So you'll be able to get into the different shows as long as there's space. But you'll be able to see a variety of the different acts, and I really do highly recommend that on Saturday you go and see Rye. So call us now, 818-985-5735, if you're interested in tickets to the Culture Collide Festival, which features Alice Russell, King Khan and the Shrines, and Rye, in addition to a wide variety of other bands going on the 10th, 11th, and 12th of October this coming weekend. Call us now for that, 818-985-5735. I'll leave you with one track from Rye. This one is Last Dance, once again from their album Woman. And that'll pretty much close it out for us, I think, here at Melting Pot. Folk Scene's up next. And y'all take care. And thanks once again, Robin, for coming in.
Pleasure.
Tell me lies and lullabies, but don't tell me to change. Tell me to change.